Join RNIB Connect and become part of a wider and stronger community led by blind and partially sighted people. Membership is free, and it's the best way to keep in touch with things that are of interest and help to you. You'll receive Connect magazine, our membership publication, in your chosen format, as well as having the chance to be amongst thousands of like-minded, blind and partially sighted people, friends, families and supporters. You'll also be able to take part in and organise social activities in your area, campaign for change and improve the lives of people with little or no sight, and get help from our dedicated RNIB Connect support team. It couldn't be easier to join RNIB Connect. Simply complete the online form at rnib.org.uk or join over the phone by calling 0303 1234 555.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Connect. This is the programme where you get the chance to talk about the issues that matter to you here on RNIB Connect Radio. Hello, I'm Stephen Scott with you for another hour, and this week we ask the question, what is it like to get into the world of work? Well, we ask two successful people in work who happen to be totally blind themselves. We'll also be talking about religion again this week with one of our listeners who wanted to share his thoughts on the world of religion and disability. And should you give up your seat if a blind person gets on the bus? We ask our blind audience for their feelings on this.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
But first, if you're a regular listener to RNIB Connect Radio, you may be aware of the Big Connection that started recently. It's a series of events aimed at bringing the community of blind and partially sighted people together in local areas across the country. Every event in each area is different and is as simple as a coffee and cake stall in a local cafe, all the way up to a full-blown event with speakers and hosts. And that is the kind of event we are going to focus on today on the show. In Leeds, an employment event recently aimed at building people's confidence to get out into the workplace was held. It featured a range of sessions focused on sharing handy hints and tips, as well as opportunities to try out your interview skills in a mock interview situation. It also gave you the chance to learn about access to work and how it can help you in the workplace through technology support as well as travel and in-work help. Ahead of the event, community reporters Natasha Marcy and Chloe Teer sat down with three big hitters in the world of employment. All of them are totally blind. In this episode, we're going to hear from two of them. That is RNIB Chair Ellie Southwood and former Government Minister and MP David Blunkett. We start with David Blunkett. He shared his story of growing up with sight loss and how he managed to find a job and progress to the dizzy heights of Home Secretary in the Labour government.
Like most blind children, I had a fairly iffy early education. I think it's improved enormously over the last few years, not least because more children are going into open education if they can, because we have multiple handicap now in a way that wasn't true many years ago. So I had a bit of a struggle. By the time I was 16, I was at what might be called an intermediate technical school, because there was a really rigid selection system when I was young. And the secondary school, which was based in Manchester, really just put people through to basket weaving and working in workshops, which for some people was a lifeline, but for me sounded like a nightmare. The posh grammar school for boys, there was only one in England, at Worcester, had a very rigid system, including not taking children who they thought would be disruptive. So I didn't even get to take the final set of exams. So I went to this school in Shropshire on the Welsh border. It's moved now and is a further education college in Hereford called the Royal National College, the RNC. Before I got to the post-16 bit, I got nothing, what were then O-levels, now GCSEs. So, cut a long story short, a number of us went down to the technical college in the evening in Shrewsbury. We started to build up O-levels. When we miraculously passed the first few, because we were only doing it one night a week, and I was taking two qualifications each year. After 3 years, I'd got enough to be able to go on to A-levels, and I moved back to Sheffield, got a job in, Lord help us, in the industry where my dad had been killed in a works accident. The quid pro quo for them was they gave me day release. I did a business qualification one day a week. I carried on going to night school, got the A-levels, got the National Certificate in Business Studies, got to university at the age of 22, and the rest is history.
So when you were growing up, did you see yourself as limited because of your visual impairment?
I thought that I was limited by the options offered me. I was limited by the attitude of those around me who should have known better. The principal of the college at that time, who had a PhD, Dr. Langdon, who was the one who didn't believe that blind youngsters could do the external exams, limiting us incredibly at the time to a very small number of options, music and piano tuning, which some of my friends did. In my case, doing a commercial course, I learnt to use Braille shorthand and to type, what became known as word processing. That did help because it enabled me to write essays, to be able to communicate. It wasn't in itself a job I wanted to do, although when I was back in Sheffield working for the Gas Board, as it was then, I did actually use those skills at work as well as for studying, so they at least gave me a foothold. And I think my message is that very often the start that youngsters who can't see or have got partial sight in life is very limited, but they shouldn't be limited by other people's perceptions. They should believe, well, whatever I'm doing at the moment is a stepping stone. It's something that will perhaps enable me to go further, to think about what the next options might be, to take those opportunities of training or retraining, just grabbing whatever looks appropriate. You should only do what you feel comfortable with, because otherwise you're going to have a miserable time at work. But sometimes it will be boring. Sometimes it will be not what you want to do in the long term, but you're going to do it because it's a bridge between where you are now and where you'd like to be.
Do you think opportunities have changed now?
I think opportunities have opened up for study in the way that I didn't experience because of the internet. I mean, I have a computer, I have an iPhone, which I'm gradually adapting to use, but I am, to be honest, I am useless. Not because I can't see, not even because I'm mature in years, but because I just don't have an aptitude for it. And because I've been very fortunate, the further up the ladder I climbed, the more support I got. It was quicker and easier to get other people to do things rather than doing them myself, which is not a good message. But it's true of life that the higher you climb, the more help you get. So when you're at the beginning of the process of getting a job, holding a job, progressing in a job, you get very limited support. I didn't have any support when I first went into a job as a teacher. I got a postgraduate teaching certificate and I taught in a further education college. And I was also at that moment on the city council as a very young councillor. The only help I got was from my then wife, who I didn't realise resented having to do this as much as she did. And I learnt that lesson very painfully. What I did get eventually on the council was to get them to give me support, which would now be available for those in work through Access to Work, which didn't exist at the time. And I'm really keen that we should get the message across that both to young people seeking a job or people returning to a job, and particularly to employers, that Access to Work is there. It can provide adaptations, it can provide equipment, it can provide a reader. And the government have just reversed the cut they were making and the restriction, and now they've put the amount that someone can claim up to 57,000, depending on their particular needs. And people should grab that with both hands. And we've got to get across to employers, interview someone. It doesn't matter whether you believe they can do it. If they believe they can do it, then there's a really good chance they will. And because they're so committed, so energised to want to do it, they'll do a better job than other people for whom maybe other options exist. So use Access to Work, use your imagination, always give somebody a chance. If they don't perform or they're clearly not going to fit in, then that's fine, but make sure it's on the fair basis, equality basis, of not giving someone a job because they're not the right person, rather than because you perceive that because of their visual impairment, they're not going to be able to do it. Let them prove to you that they can.
So you've had many roles within Parliament. So at what point did you realise you wanted this career, and what drove you towards it?
When I was in my teens, I was really interested in politics. I didn't initially think, gosh, I'm going to go into politics as a profession, as a full-timer. I thought I wanted to be a teacher, and I became a teacher, and I loved it, although it was damned hard work, and you had to use all the skills that I've adapted for politics to be able to survive, because some of the youngsters that I was were teaching at the time would have run over their grandmother if she'd fallen down in front of the car. So it was a tough learning curve. But once I'd got that under my belt and got onto the city council, I thought, I want to do well in for the city and for the people I represented. And I was able to, because I first became chair of what would now be called adult services. It encompassed children's services as well. We called it family and community services. And then I became leader of the council. And as leader of the council, I was really able, particularly all those years ago, to be able to exercise some influence, because we had, even in the teeth of Margaret Thatcher's regime and her cutbacks to local government, we had ways of getting around it that local government don't have at the moment. We controlled very large sums of money, including in the education system. We employed over 40,000 people, and it was possible to make a difference. But it was also obvious from the attacks that were taking place on local government that it was necessary, A, for my party to get elected, and B, I wanted to be elected when they were. I wanted to be there. So in 87, I got the chance of standing in the area that I was brought up in, that I represented on the council. And that was a tremendous opportunity, because if you can represent your home community and your home city, then you have that driving force for change and for making a difference. And I was able to do that. 10 years in opposition was excruciating, but I was lucky because I was on the front bench. I was very quickly promoted. I think they wanted me inside the tent rather than what they described from outside the tent, because I was very bumptious and driven. And when I got the chance, firstly to be Shadow Health Secretary and then Shadow Education and subsequently combined with employment, that was wonderful, because education and employment were my two great policy driving forces, and they still are. I'm still engaged in a number of ways with both education and employment opportunities. And of course, when we were elected in 97, I then had the God-given opportunity and the privilege of being able to do it, and to be able to bring about that change.
So I'd just like to say that the article you wrote for Financial Times about talking on disabled employees was an incredible piece. So for individuals who were nervous about disclosing their disability, what would your advice for them be?
Well, I know people who have got interviews by not disclosing, but I think sometimes the shock can be so great to the employer, they haven't prepared, they haven't got alternative ways of assisting, which might be helpful in getting through the interview. Or these days, of course, interviews aren't just talking. They're also often undertaking an exercise. And to undertake the exercise, you need to be prepared, and they need to be prepared to be helpful. So I've also had people come to me where they've arrived at the interview and there's been no alternative provision for reading the document or for how the computer would be accessed, because every computer system is different, and you know, just plonk it in front of somebody, they're bewildered already and nervous, then it could be the end of the opportunity. So my advice would be to explain right up front and to make it totally clear that you have the wherewithal, you have the will, you have sufficient training at that point for the job, you want to progress, you know how to use the equipment and access to work's available. And if you can get all the ducks, including your brilliant CV and that needs to include how committed and energised you are, and that you know you're on a learning curve and you want to progress and you want to learn more, then that would be very good. The other bit is do your homework on the job. Try and do as much as you can to learn about what the company is or the public service is, what do they do, what are they looking for, to think through what kind of questions you'll be asked. And when you're given an exercise, try and work out what is it they want out of this, rather than just going straight for it, blundering into it, because you know you're competing with other people who can easily look round or get on the net and see what's happening. So it doesn't ever help, doesn't ever do any harm to actually have done far more homework than you would ever want to do in order to get that foothold.
So when in employment, you've said that you often have to work harder in order to be seen as capable of the role. To what extent do you see this as a downside of having a disability?
Well, the downside is that you don't get as much as a work-life balance and as much as a life as you would wish at that time. And I think it's a battle inside you. You know you've got to go the extra mile, do the work in the evenings or at weekends, be there when other people are not. A commitment that gets really irritating when you're a particular age and you want to go out partying and whatever you call it these days, going to a gig. And you know that you've really got to knuckle down. And I think I got that balance wrong. I, now thinking back, would have just tweaked a bit. I'd have just done a bit more of the enjoyment and the social life and the connectivity outside without completely undermining the deep commitment to making it work. I think my problem was that I was proving not just to myself but the rest of the world that I could do it and it was doable. And I think I got to the stage where I'd proved it and I didn't have to keep on proving it again and again. But that is a fine judgment that you have to make. You don't want a miserable life. You want to get a good foundation. Relationships are crucial and make life worth living. So go do that as well and make it a plus. And take my advice, don't get your partner to do things for you that somebody paid should be doing.
And later we'll be hearing more from Ellie Southwood, the chair of RNIB, on the subject of employment and how she got into the world of work. Now, an interesting story to throw in here. The gap between the pay for disabled and other workers has increased to its highest level since 2013. Research by the TUC reveals it stands at more than £2,300 a year. Figures also show the average hourly pay for disabled employees was £9.90 in 2017. That's £1.50 lower than non-disabled workers. Let's hear now from Nicola Smith from the Union Group, who says employers could be doing more.
This research shows that too many disabled people face lower pay and worse jobs than their non-disabled peers. On average, disabled workers are earning £2,730 a year less than average non-disabled workers. That's only around £9.90 an hour compared to around £11.40 an hour for a non-disabled employee. Not only is this pay gap very significant, but it's also the highest it's been since data began collection in 2013. So we're concerned both about the scale of the pay gap and also that it's going up. This sort of discrimination against disabled people simply unacceptable. We know that disabled people are already less likely to be in paid work, but now this research shows that when disabled people are in paid jobs, they're also far likely to learn as much as their non-disabled peers. The government can't just sit by and let this sort of pay discrimination keep happening. We need to see significant action to make sure that disabled people both have a good chance of getting into jobs, and when they're there, that they get paid fairly. We know that this pay gap is caused by a range of different factors. including the fact that disabled people are more likely to be in part-time work, less likely to be able to find full-time employment, and more likely to be working in lower paid occupations. So we need employers to take their duties to make reasonable adjustments for disabled workers seriously. We need to make sure that proper support is available from Access to Work, that's from government to employers, to help with the costs, any costs of those adjustments. And we need to make sure that more access to better quality, decent, flexible work is available, with, for example, all jobs being advertised flexibly from the first point at which they're advertised. There's huge amounts of change that employers and government could take to tackle this pay gap. It's just not acceptable that disabled workers are earning more than £2,000 a year less than average than non-disabled employees.
And I'm sure we'll be talking more about that story in the coming weeks. If you have a view, tell us about it. The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. Now, you might remember that a couple of weeks ago on the Weekly Connect, we spoke to Sheila Armstrong from the Torch Trust about the organisation and her feelings on the relationship between disability and faith. One of our listeners, Tim Rayner, got in touch following that interview to give us his thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to hear what she had to say. And I think sort of some of what I wanted to talk about, it kind of piggybacks off the back of that, maybe more on a sort of personal level.
Okay, so let's get into that a little bit then. So you heard what Sheila talked about regarding religion and obviously her role at Torch Trust. What's your take on disability and faith?
I think a lot of it revolves around, how could I say it? So my personal experiences of sight loss, for me, I think from the sound of the way Sheila's speaking, she's been with sight loss for quite a long time, so she would have a different perspective. For me, still quite raw. It was only a few years ago. And in a lot of ways, sight loss kind of challenged but reaffirmed some of my feelings about my own personal faith. And I think a lot of thoughts and feelings I had around about the way that I as a Christian sort of handle things like suffering, handle personal suffering and the suffering of others. So I think it's quite a big can of worms to open, but I think it's an important one for anybody of faith to think about.
Okay, so let's use the analogy of the can of worms. What is the first worm to come crawling out when you open this?
I think with a lot of people, the first thing you can get is that sort of, well, you know, how can you believe in God when there's so much suffering? Or, you know, particularly with my situation, how can you believe in God when there's so much personal suffering in your life? And I think I think with a lot of people, there's a kind of, as human beings, we can be a little, I wouldn't say lazy as such, but we tend to sometimes look for the easy answer. And I think people assume sometimes that religion is about looking for those easy answers, the quick way out. In actual fact, I think sometimes that's not always the case. Sometimes it's more of a journey. It's more of a discovery. And I think the main point about Christianity, as with many other faiths, is that you've got somebody traveling on that journey with you. That it's not always about God coming in and immediately fixing all your problems, but actually about God being by your side while you're going through them and experiencing them with you.
Have you ever been angry at God or indeed your religion in any way relating to your vision?
I remember when a significant point in my sight loss journey was when I lost sight in an entire eye after an accidental bacterial infection during an operation. And, I went outside, I raised my fist at God and I probably let off a stream of invectives that people wouldn't necessarily listen to in church. And I think part of being a Christian is about being honest with yourself. I wouldn't say, you know, I wouldn't choose to swear, but I think that the way that I was feeling at that time is very difficult not to. But actually, you know, when I look in the Bible, I see in the book of Job making complaints at God. I see Isaiah moaning at him. So it's like, it's not as if that's the best course of action to take, but he's kind of got quite broad shoulders. And I think a lot of people of faith and Christians feel like, oh, getting angry in a situation, getting angry at God is not something I'm allowed to do. And I think so long as you come through that journey, I think it's actually a very valid thing to do. Things happen in your life that make you angry, that make you frustrated, and not to express that at all to somebody who's supposed to be at the center of your life. Actually, it's just dishonest, and it's actually more honest to express that anger and work through it than it is to pretend that everything's sunshine and roses and you're happy because Jesus loves you. You know, those things are things I believe. I believe that, you know, God does do things for good, that Jesus does love me. But to pretend that instead of being honest when I'm angry, when I'm frustrated, when I'm hurting, it's not going to do anything. You're talking about a belief in a person who knows everything about you. So why pretend to be anything other than what you are? Why be dishonest about it?
Do you think your faith allows you to face your fears, your inner demons, all of that? Does it allow you to sort of bring all this to the fore and actually confront any feelings you have?
Definitely. I think, you know, there have been times when I've just known, not known what to do in a situation. And I think just looking to that external source for help, just crying out, I think can be the most transformative experience in your life. Just, you know, sometimes it's about something personal. Sometimes it's just about how awful the world is. And just, I find great comfort in going to the scriptures. I find great comfort in spending time thinking and praying around it, and, you know, essentially feeling God drawing close to me in the situation I'm in. Again, I think going back to what I said before, it's about that reality. It's about being real and raw, not dressing it up in pretty language, but just meeting God where you're at, and believing that that's where he's going to meet you too.
There's often that discussion around anything relating to religion. Usually the argument that's given is, you know, if some terrible tragedy occurs somewhere in the world, there's often the, how can a God who's supposed to be all-loving and all-forgiving allow this to happen in his world that he's created? Where do you stand on all of that? And do you ever wonder about why you've ended up with this eye condition and what relationship that may have to God?
It's kind of two ways to answer that. And I suppose they touch on what was talked about in the last edition with the, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name, the
Sheila.
Lady from Sheila from Torch Trust. So it's kind of on the level of bad things happening to me on a quite personal level, there's a belief, as all Christians, is that God works together for the good of those who love him. And sometimes that's not an immediate thing. Sometimes that's something that takes a long time to work out. But I think an example would be that, and after my sight loss, I'd been sort of in the doldrums. I'd been about 8 years unemployed at the point when I was starting to lose my sight. It was the sort of joint occurrences of finding a woman I wanted to spend the rest of my life with, and kind of ironically having this devastating sight loss that kind of gave me a bit of a kick up the backside and made me realize that I needed to start working at things. And I got employed. I was in that job for a year. Again, things started to look bad. I had some workplace bullying. Things seemed to be going downwards. But then I moved from that job into a job in the RNIB, which was a better pay grade, a better group of people to work with, a much more understanding group of people. So I think it's quite easy to look at things and say, well, you know, where's God in the suffering in that sense? But there is that firm belief that in the long term and ultimately God's working for the good. I mean, the second part of that, the more sort of a little bit more philosophical part of that is really, for Christians at least, you have this thing where you don't have a God who you can make the accusation, oh, well, you don't know what it's like. You've got a God who has actually become a man and been beaten, been abused, being executed in the most horrific way possible. So that whole thing of it comes back to the whole thing of God going alongside you in these things. It's not just a sense of him coming alongside me in person, which I do have, but it's also the fact that if I look at anything and I just say, well, and start to say, you don't understand. I then look at the life of Jesus and I think, well, no, hang on. No, actually, you've been through worse. Actually, you've been through worse than I've been. And I think any belief has to stand up to the test of a difficult world. You know, I think I alluded a little earlier on about people who think it's all about simplicity. And the easiest way to tell a cult from a true religion is if they've got it all neatly laid out in neat rows, with neat solutions, you can guarantee that's going to be a cult. You're going to guarantee that's going to be something that's going to control people, going to manipulate people, because it's not operating in the area of truth. It's not telling people about the world in the way it really is. And I think for me, my faith is about living in the real world, a world which does have difficulty and does have pain, and confronting that and dealing with that with the help of my beliefs and with the help of the God that I believe in.
There are some who will say that they feel blessed with sight loss. And as someone who's not particularly religious, I often find that a bit hard to quantify. Can you make sense of that?
It's not a belief I have myself in terms of feeling blessed per se. I think I've been blessed since sight loss. I think I've had blessings in a strange way through sight loss, in that some of the things that have happened since I've lost my sight wouldn't have happened if I hadn't lost my sight, if I hadn't lost some of my sight. I wouldn't call it a blessing myself. I suppose an analogy would be, to look at it that way, would be the difference in opinion between, say, somebody who has been blind since birth and somebody who has come to blindness later in life. And actually, if you ask some people who have been blind since birth, they will say, well, I don't need to see. So it's a very sort of personal point of view, because there's an awful lot of people who wouldn't understand somebody saying, I don't need to see. And I think in a way, the sort of blindness has been a blessing. It comes from a similar viewpoint, in that it's not what the mainstream thinks. It's not what people generally think. But if that's how that person feels, then it's valid. If they feel they've got more out of being blind than they did when they were being sighted, then, you know, who am I to argue that God hasn't blessed them through that? Personally, I like art. I like designing. I've lost some of my color perception and a few other things since losing my sight. I wouldn't say that was a blessing, but I would say that on the whole, I feel blessed. So it's a difficult one to answer why some people feel that way, because it isn't something that I personally feel. But I would still bless God for everything that's happened to me, because of that belief in there being a reason for everything. There's a story by an amazing woman called Corrie Ten Boom, who was in a concentration camp, and she was speaking to her friends in a Christian prayer group about thanking God for everything. And she thanked God for the fleas. And at the time, nobody could understand why she would do that. But later on, they discovered that the guards were keeping away from their meetings because of the fleas that they had on their body, and that they were able to do things in secret. And I think there is that thing where something that doesn't seem like a blessing, that doesn't seem like something good, can actually be used to good effect. So I think I can understand that. I'm not sure I'm of the same opinion of people who see blindness itself per se as a blessing, but I can understand how it can be in some circumstances.
It's been really interesting talking to you, Timothy. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, a debate has been ignited in the blind community around whether or not a blind person is entitled to a seat on the bus if the bus is full. There are various blogs and social media posts from various blind people who have started this conversation. Some say yes, some say no. Well, we thought we'd find out what you think by posting the question on our popular audio social media platform, Voreal. Here's what you had to say.
Hi, Stephen. It's Joe here in Belfast in Northern Ireland. This is only my opinion. I don't claim to speak for anybody. But I think, personally, no, a blind person shouldn't expect a seat on a bus. I mean, if someone offers you one out of just human decency and courtesy, that's lovely. But the same way as I'm totally by myself, and I'd jump up if I became aware or heard an older person or maybe a lady who was pregnant or, you know, something like that, or somebody else who I thought needed a seat more than I did, and there was no more seats. I mean, I think it's just a human decency thing. But no, as a general rule, I don't think blind people should expect a seat on the bus automatically. At the end of the day, yes, our eyes don't work, but I think our legs. Well, I'm just saying very generally. If your legs work fine, then you know, so you're the same as everybody else, aren't you? That said, I know that guide dog owners, I'm not one myself, I'm a cane user, but I know guide dog owners say that for the dog's sake, a seat is better. So yeah, fair enough.
My name is Rachel. I personally think that it's a free offer, you know, you're guaranteeing me a seat. So I see it as a good gesture, and I'm lazy, I like to sit down. I mean, especially for a long ride, I mean, guaranteeing me a seat is pretty cool, so I'll take it. I'm not going to be rude and make a big scene out of nothing. You know, if you're going to offer me a seat, I'm just going to take it.
Do you know, I'm in kind of the camp where my legs are fine, it's my eyes that don't work. And this takes me back to when I was travelling through London just before I gave up work, and I used to catch a tube every day to and from train station offices. And always remember one time I jumped on the Bakerloo line, and I'm not on it for very long, so I jumped through the doors and moved my way to the opposite doors and just hang on to the rail. And I had my cane in my hand, and there was a lady sat opposite me right on the edge of the bench, and said, would I like to sit down? And it surprised me, because that's the first time I'd experienced that before, and I could tell in her voice she was clearly older than I was. So, you know, I declined and thanked her, but declined, you know. And it's always stuck in my mind, and thought, my legs, they're okay, you know, I don't need to sit down, I'm fine, as long as I've got somewhere where I'm not in anybody's way and I can hang on and I know where I am, I'm fine, you know, I don't need to, I'm in the mind where I don't need to sit down. I suppose it would be different if I was older or I had some mobility issues other than being blind, or even if I had a guide dog with me that might need to be tucked under a seat. But other than that, no, I'm not it doesn't make any difference to me. I'd rather stand and let somebody else take the seat that might need it more than I do.
Hi there, it's Anthony, and I'm from the US. No, I don't really think so. I don't think that being blind should automatically entitle you to have a seat on a bus.
If the bus is packed, then I think it's probably best to be offered a seat, mainly because it kind of falls into the issue of being a health and safety problem then, because with us being blind or visually impaired or however anyone wants to describe themselves, then it's It's not easy for us to be able to stand up straight or stand in one spot when a bus is going around a corner, for instance. However, if the bus is not packed, then I don't see why people can't find their own seats. That's just coming from my opinion, because even though it's a little bit time consuming of putting my hand on each individual seat and deciding whether or not someone's in that seat is a little bit difficult, it's only time consuming. It's easier for me to do that than it is to wait around for someone to say, would you like this seat? So yeah, that's just my opinion.
A mixed bag of comments, it would appear. Well, we got a tweet in from Ken Reed as well, who says, balance is made of sight, ears and posture. Take away one part and it becomes harder. A seat on a bus isn't a right, but it is safer. Well, share your thoughts. You can email them in to RNIB by sending an email to theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk.
Join me, Alan Russell, and my guests as we take a look through your early morning papers. We also look at issues around sight loss at a local level.
And our main goal is to fundraise and completely develop the area in the school into a beautiful sensory garden.
A national level.
Yes, yeah, so See My Voice. It's a leadership programme for young people between the ages of 11 and 18 with a visual impairment. What young people that are part of the programme should get out of it is they should develop a range of skills that are transferable to all aspects of their lives, using the vehicle of sport to develop those skills.
And an international level.
We offer three individuals up to $25,000 each to go out and complete the project of their dreams.
And of course, some great chats with my guest.
Rob Arthur says his brother-in-law, Ian, is an electrician and he's overdue to retire, hence the nickname Jurassic Spark.
And Tom was called Top Cat. What were you called, Patricia?
What, as a teacher?
Oh, we yes. Don't want to know what the pupils
what
called
was that?
Mrs. Soggy Bananas.
Patricia's surname being Savan Mook.
Soggy Bananas.
So join me, Alan Russell, and my guests weekdays from 7 a.m.
The Early Edition on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB understands the challenges and concerns facing employers when taking on someone with sight loss or when an existing employee begins losing their sight. That's why RNIB have published a new Guide for Employers. The guide addresses common questions and sets out the benefits of employing a blind or partially sighted person. It covers everything an employer needs to know about employing someone with sight loss, from the recruitment and interview process to making sure the right equipment is in place for the employee to be successful in carrying out their role and progressing their career. To learn more about the RNIB's Guide for Employers and download a copy, visit rnib.org.uk/employing-someone, or to obtain a free hard copy, email employmentservices@rnib.org.uk.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Earlier, we heard from David Blunkett, the former government minister and MP, talking about his life and career and how he got into the world of employment. Our community reporters Natasha Marcy and Chloe Tier also sat down with new RNIB chair Ellie Southwood, who took up the post last year. Ellie talked about her early life in business and how she got involved in politics and ultimately into her new role at RNIB.
After I left university, I'd done a degree that basically left all options open. So I did philosophy, politics and economics, and lots of my friends at the time, I think unkindly, called it degree level general studies, in the sense that, you know, I could have gone into anything. So I started my career in research jobs for sort of think tanks who were looking at ways that local government works and specialised in sort of how local government runs services, how they work in partnership with private sector companies sometimes to run those services. And what that gave me was a really strong interest in public services. So then I went to the Confederation of British Industry as a policy researcher, and I did that sort of work for a few years. And then I spent 4 or 5 years as a headhunter. So interviewing people, like you're interviewing me now for jobs. It's always more fun interviewing than being interviewed, right? So so I did that for a few years, and that was really, really fun. And then I, in 2011, I left. And since then, I got elected as a local councillor in 2014. So I've just been elected a couple of weeks ago for a second four-year term as a local councillor. And I'm in the council's cabinet, and I've just changed jobs. So I had responsibility for bins and parking and potholes and pavements and all of those street clutter things that that R&IB campaigns on. But I've just been given the job of housing and welfare reform. So that's all about homelessness in my part of Northwest London, and some really, you know, interesting and challenging issues. So in the other part of my life, that's what I do when I'm not being chair of R&IB.
In what way do you believe working as a councillor prepared you for being the chair of R&IB?
It gave me lots of experience at managing meetings, especially managing meetings where not everybody agrees, which is the sort of meetings we like, because, you know, people have opinions, and it's really important that we hear everybody's different opinions. But ultimately, a decision needs to be made. And so it gave me some really great sort of helpful experience of that. Also, you know, and you'll know, one of the things that I've worked really hard on is trying to get R&IB Connect off the ground. And some of that was based on my experience of working with local community groups as a councillor, and, you know, figuring out that actually a lot of people just don't feel part of how decisions are made, that are decisions about them and about their lives. And I felt really strongly that I wanted every blind and partially sighted person to feel, you know, we are, you know, Royal National Institute of Blind People, and so we need to make that real.
So we know that community is a very important aspect of R&IB, but how do you feel you could input towards this and obviously continue to input towards it?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. So I've worked to, I suppose, support the staff teams to get everything in place so that we're ready to go. But I don't think it's the sort of thing that once you've put those things in place, you can walk away and say, great, we've got a thriving community now. You know, this will evolve and build over time. And the way that I can continue to be involved is to keep meeting, you know, groups of blind and partially sighted people and just people I come across, and just and listening and finding, you know, ways to make sure that people are able to not just input into the work of R&IB, but to really, you know, be at the heart of it and steer it, because it is our organisation. So we've got 10 people on the board at the moment, 8 of whom are visually impaired. And that's really important, because who leads our organisation is really, really important. We've got, you know, other committees that sit underneath the board that all have blind and visually impaired people on them. And we will actually soon be advertising for some new people to join those committees. So that, I think that's another really important thing, is to keep opening up opportunities to new people. You know, so it's not just the same old people all the time. And then finding other ways for people to be involved. So we're looking at, you know, how we involve, you know, people who maybe buy things from R&IB or want to be part of our services, or people who currently we're not providing the right things for or able to help. So it's finding the right ways for people to be involved. And that's the way, you know, it's not R&IB deciding on those ways. It's going out to people and, you know, asking, how do you want to be involved? Going out to people rather than expecting people to come to us all the time.
Definitely. So if we're going back to the topic of employment, obviously R&IB have campaigns that look at this, but what issues have you faced when being in employment, and how did you overcome them?
One of the things that on reflection, especially when I was really junior and just starting out, was it's really hard to know what help you need when you've never had a job before. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to, you know, walk into a job and say, okay, I understand what this job is and I know I can do it, but I need this to help me. If you haven't done it before, I just think that's really hard. And so I think one of the things that really helped me was talking to other blind and partially sighted people who were more senior, you know, and who could say, well, try this, because otherwise I think it can be really, really difficult to know just off the top of your head. I think the other thing is, it's like an ongoing, very important thing to make sure your colleagues sort of feel comfortable asking if they don't know, you know, because I think we've probably all been in situations where people have made assumptions about us and what we do and don't want, what we can and can't do, and actually making it okay for people to ask, you know, without it being the only thing that people talk to you about, that's quite a tough thing as well, because people don't want to get it wrong, and they don't, you know, we all want to be known for the jobs we do and to be promoted because of the jobs we do, and not necessarily always to be about our disability. So I think striking that balance can be quite hard, and helping people to engage with the things that really matter. So, you know, of course, if there's boxes all over the office, that's quite hard, but that's not really, for me, the issue. You know, I use a cane and therefore I'm likely to find things rather than fall over them. The real issue is about not knowing who's in meeting rooms, getting to unfamiliar meetings. It's about, you know, making sure that I can contribute in meetings. Mm. And those are the things. And they're sometimes harder to fix than moving boxes out of corridors.
Another issue that we found that people find tricky is when to disclose your disability. Mm. So what would your advice be on that?
So I have always disclosed at interview, I think. I'm just thinking back. I'm thinking back over all, you know, all the sort of processes I've been through in applying for jobs. Sometimes I have disclosed on application forms, but I have always actively disclosed if someone rings and invites me to an interview, because I, you know, need to be able to get to the interview for a start. And also, I feel like if I walk in as a blind candidate, I need for some of that inevitable, not surprise, but some of that to be taken away, because I want to be seen as a candidate. And if people are still thinking, oh, she's blind, you know, I'd rather they knew that in advance and had a bit of time to process that rather than make it all part, because otherwise it's too distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And then at interview, I found one of the things I've tried a couple of times is when they ask, you know, have you got any questions for us? It's a really great time to say, look, you know, obviously I'm blind, and I'd like to just share with you how I will do this job if I'm offered it. Because often people don't ask, but they are thinking. You know, they're thinking, well, how's she gonna read her emails? How's she actually gonna do it? And nobody will ask, because it's awkward, and people obviously are aware that, you know, blurting out things like that is not cool and not how we should do things. Yeah. But actually sometimes taking that away. So there's some, I suppose, practical bits about disclosure, but also just some bits that help the process go more smoothly, I think.
Do you feel like you've had to work harder to prove yourself because of having a VI?
In some ways, yeah. I think I often, when I think about it, I think about, do I have to work harder because I'm blind than I do because I'm a woman? So there's lots of things about gender and how, you know, how women typically have to sort of overperform in order to get on the level playing field. And I think disability is the same, and if not more so. Mm. So, yes, I think you do need to be performing at a level which I think does take more energy, probably is the way I'd summarise it. More hard work, you know. None of my previous employers will know of the extra hours that I had to put in at weekends and stuff just to keep up, or just to get to a point where actually you can perform on a level with other people. And I think, again, it's particularly important when you're quite junior, because as you get more senior, people sort of know what your role is, and they kind of will pitch in and help sometimes. And if you've got a team, sometimes you can, you know, build the work around the different skills you've got in the team, including yourself. And so you do the things that make sense for you to do. But when you've got no control or choice over that, I think starting out, that can be particularly challenging.
Do you think public perception of disability will change, and that'll improve employment prospects for people with disabilities, or do you think it's always going to be a really tricky market?
I think it has to change. I think it has to change because, you know, we have to deal with the fact that actually the number of blind and partially sighted people in employment has fallen over the past 10 years. Mm. You know, that is a really appalling situation, and we have to improve that. And one of the most powerful ways to improve that, I think, is for working with or for someone who's blind or partially sighted to not be a totally weird thing, you know, to be something that, oh yeah, I had a boss who was blind, or, you know,
yeah.
Because it makes it the norm. It makes it not
the stigma.
Yeah, I think it does. So I think seeing more of us around and about and in different types of work is really important. And, you know, making sure that those networks exist as well, so that we can help each other. Lots of other networks exist, and I'm not convinced that there is such a strong network amongst blind and partially sighted people as there is, you know, among the, you know, there's lots of women's networks, there's lots of you know, BME networks, and there are some disability networks, but not as many. But specifically, I think we're not always good at helping each other.
So, to what extent do you believe your personal experiences have aided you to support others with sight loss?
I've certainly made some mistakes that I can reflect on and share with other people in the hope that they don't, you know, because we will build on experiences. But also, you know, I've had several different jobs. You know, I've done those policy jobs, I've done a recruitment job, I've been, you know, I'm a politician. And I've also got this, you know, non-executive role in a large charity. And they are four quite different things. And so I think, you know, that's experience that you know, helps, I suppose, to just explore how sight loss works in different sorts of environments. So definitely my personal experience does, I think, bring with it some interesting reflections, which certainly helped me, and which, you know, I would love to be able to support other people with as well. But I learn from people every day too. So those same people who I asked for help, you know, when I first went into my first job, we still chat, you know, they're still helping me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just that network, really, and finding ways and finding people who you really relate to, who can help you. And the experience of being blind or partially sighted in a workplace is something that I think we all need to share.
And next week we'll be talking to Lord Chris Holmes of Richmond, a prominent peer in the House of Lords, about how he got into the job market as a blind person and what he is doing now to help others through technological advances and changing social attitudes. That plus lots more on next week's Weekly Connect. Remember, if you want to get in touch and tell us your thoughts on any story at all, then please do. We'd love to hear your thoughts at theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk is the email address to send your thoughts to. And check out that app Voreal as well. It's available on the iPhone, and it's a social media platform run purely on audio. So if you've got something you want to say and get off your chest, well, share your thoughts with other blind people around the world as well. That is it for us this week. Thank you again. And remember, when it's Mondays at 1, it's the Weekly Connect. Goodbye.